Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work, the 25th since the election of Donald Trump. And I'll be joined today by Peter Schrag, author and longtime editor at the Sacramento Bee, about his latest book, California Fights Back, The Golden State in the Age of Trump. After hosting and producing the show for nearly two decades in 2014, I stopped recording new live interviews, and the show continued on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives each week. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. But with the election of Donald Trump, I could not resist exploring the path forward in new interviews. And this is the 25th, as I said, that I've recorded so far. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book, No Is Not Enough, Erwin Chemerinsky on legal issues. You get the idea. And they're all available on my website and at iTunes. And before each show, I like to offer a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward the healthy and just future we need. You can email me at temcnally@mac.com to get these websites and more information. Indivisible Guide, one word, indivisibleguide.com, probably the most extensive network of organizations around the country. I think it's about 5,000, actually. Very on top of things. OurRevolution.com, that's the organization that grew out of the Sanders campaign. That's one word, Our Revolution. MoveOn.org, which is, you know, MoveOn's been around forever, but their focus was mostly on the digital. In this current incarnation, they are working much more closely with grassroots folks on the ground. That's also true for CourageCampaign.org, a California organization. Two that are very specific, TownHallProject.com tells you when your local representatives are going to be in town for town halls. And 5Calls, that's the number 5 and the word calls.org, which tells you the relevant calls you might want to make to your representatives because of issues and legislation that's going forward. And one that I'm going to add this week, I've interviewed David K. Johnston a couple of times this in the last several months, and he has a thing called DC Report, singular, dcreport.org, and they are an up-to-the-minute sort of report on what is going on behind the scenes and actions you can take. Now to today's guest. First, let me set this up. On November 9th, 2016, the day after the election last year, I read an op-ed that argued that California ought to secede from the U.S. And at that moment, that morning, I was sorely tempted to fall in line and join the cause. To finally live in a country that in so many ways was forward-looking, innovative, inclusive, that was actively wrestling with accelerating change rather than resisting it. A country that stands for most of what I stand for. How would that feel? A country with flaws and challenges, but one where I could feel a part of a people that was working to do better. Then I imagined what the rest of the U.S., still the richest, most militarily powerful nation on earth, would be like without us. Plus the fact that it was pretty much impossible to secede without violence, and I put the notion aside, but not the feeling. Peter Schrag, today's guest, suggests that without secession, California can act in many ways like an independent country. And he makes the case that in the 15 months since Trump's election, and I'm going to quote him here, no party, no lobby, no organization has been as formidable an adversary to the Washington of Donald Trump, Paul Ryan, and Mitch McConnell as California. None has both the will and the heft that California brings to this fight, and none has been as determined. And he reminds us also in this book that this has not always been so, that California has come a long way. And let me point that out with this comment. In the days following the inauguration, I attended a community meeting about how California, and Southern California in particular, could deal with the effects of the election. And towards the end of the meeting, I was moved by the words of a Latina activist, I'm guessing in her 30s. And she told us that on November 9th, she remembered another time she'd felt just as devastated by an election. And that was in 1994. the morning after anti-immigrant Prop 187 had won. And she said, look where we are now. California has Democratic supermajorities in both houses of the legislature. No Republican holds statewide office. We lead the nation in responding to immigration, gerrymandering, and climate change. We're among the leaders in the living wage movement, and Hillary won California by 2 million votes. Peter Schrag served for 19 years as editorial page editor of the Sacramento Bee, and for many years was a visiting scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. He's written for most of our top journals, and he's the author of several books, including Paradise Lost, California's Experience, America's Future, Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America, and with Otto Schrag, When Europe Was a Prison Camp, Father and Son Memoirs. His latest, California Fights Back, the Golden State in the Age of Trump. Welcome, Peter Schrag, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell folks, we're recording this interview on February 20th. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Thanks very much, and thanks for that generous introduction.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. And you've written, you've been an editor, you've taught. How do you look at your path? What are the threads that you see weaving through your work?
Well, the thread is almost from the beginning, and as you suggested, I'm an immigrant myself, a German Jewish refugee. We got here to this country in 1941, having narrowly escaped the Nazis. Lived in actually Nazi occupied Europe for a year. From 1940 to 1941, I've come with, I think, a very strong gut sense from the time I was a kid about the importance of a democratic society, the importance of human rights, civil rights. You can't possibly have lived through that time without having that sense. And I think that's pretty much informed what I've done since. Much of my time, as you suggested again, I've spent writing about California. I've lived here now for since 1971, I guess, 72, I've been writing about California, and I've watched California go through these gyrations. As the Latina you quoted earlier said, in 1994, California's direction seemed to be very different from what it is now. In 1994, we passed Proposition 187, which sought to bar undocumented immigrants from all public services, including education. And of course, we've come an enormously long way in the years since then. And in a way, where California was in 1994 is where Donald Trump and company want to take the country now, a country that's nativist, that's very isolation, pulling back, distrusting government, all those things California seemed to try to do, or California voters seemed to try to do in 1994. I'm not sure they really were ever totally passionate about that direction, but they certainly were kicking back against immigration and kicking back against what they thought was a government they didn't trust. And so they, for the succeeding years, they've relied much more on the initiative process rather than on elected government. Now, that's changed in the years since. And again, this is an incredibly interesting and, I think, in some ways, telling story for the rest of the country, because what we've gone through, very possibly the country can go through as well. We were where Trump and company want to take the country now, and we've come through it.
That's right. And so I think that is the hopeful reflection and one of the reasons we're doing this interview. Now, in preparing for this, I came across an article you wrote for Harper's in August 1969. And let me just say, that was about the time I first visited California. I was traveling. Stereotypically, if you will, I was traveling with my girlfriend in her VW bus the summer after we'd both graduated from East Coast colleges. But your article, titled The Forgotten American, it reminds me of many such articles written after the election to explain Trump's Electoral College victory. And I'm going to read right now the first paragraph and the last paragraph of that article, and then I want you to talk a bit about that. The first paragraph of this article written in August 1969. There's hardly a language to describe him or even a set of social statistics. Just names. Racist, bigot, redneck, ethnic, Irish, Italian, Pole, hunky, Yahoo, the lower middle class, a blank. The man under whose hat lies the great American desert, who watches the tube, plays the horses, and keeps Negroes out of his union and his neighborhood, although in 69 you didn't use the word Negroes, who might vote for Wallace but didn't, who cheers when the cops beat up on demonstrators. He was once the hero of the civics books. Now he's the forgotten man, perhaps the most alienated person in America, written in August 69. And your final paragraph, a huge constituency may be coming up for grabs, and there is considerable evidence that its political mobility is more sensitive than anyone can imagine, that all the sociological determinants are not as significant as the simple facts of concern and leadership. When Robert Kennedy was killed last year, thousands of working-class people who had expected to vote for him, if not hundreds of thousands, shifted their loyalties to Wallace. A man who can change from a progressive Democrat into a bigot overnight deserves attention. Why did you write that article? What did it say to you? What did it mean to you? And what does it say about today?
Well, I think the echoes are very unavoidable. From 69, this is right after Nixon was elected, and shocked a lot of Democrats and a lot of liberals. And again, there's another side to that, or another element to that story as well, and that is that a lot of the people I knew who were mostly Democrats had abandoned Hubert Humphrey, who was the candidate at that time against Nixon. Because he had supported the Vietnam War too long. He'd been Lyndon Johnson's vice president. He finally changed tune about 2 months before the election, but a lot of people abandoned him, as I think a lot of Democrats abandoned Hillary Clinton two years ago. So there were similarities there. But I think also there was a whole constituency in this country, again, very similar to what happened in 2016, of people, mostly blue-collar, working class, whatever the description is, who felt disparaged, ignored, demeaned by the respectable folks, and were just plain angry. I suppose I can't use a four-letter word here, but the S-kickers, and that was again similar to what happened in 2016, and then of course, as I say, the good Democrats were shocked that that happened, and I think they couldn't imagine it. And then of course Nixon became president, and that. And then they suddenly were scratching their heads and wondering what happened.
Yeah, and let me point up a couple of things. When you talk about in your final paragraph of that article, someone who would have voted for Robert Kennedy and now was going to vote for Wallace. Obviously, those Rust Belt states that gave Trump the electoral victory, people who voted for Obama once or twice. Switched over and voted for Trump. An echo that's right there. And what does it say to you that we thought they were forgotten then, now nearly 50 years ago, and now we do again? Is it a cycle, or is it something that's bubbles under the surface at all times and only gets noticed when it seems to be the sort of the leverage point of change?
Well, I think it may be the latter. And one thing we should not forget, by the way, talking about 2016 is that, of course, the majority of Americans did not vote for Trump, that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by, I think, something like 3 million votes. So it isn't as if everybody, and then, of course, the fact that Trump won is one of the quirks of our cockamamie constitutional system. He did not win a majority of Americans, but I think there is there certainly is, and obviously a good part of the electorate is always going to be rooted in their party loyalties. Most Democrats are going to vote for Democrats. Most Republicans are going to vote for Republicans, no matter who the candidate is. We used to talk about yellow dog Democrats who vote for even a yellow dog if he was a Democrat. But there is that swing group of people who are sensitive to signals of various kinds from parties, from candidates, from and now, of course, we've got something here that we didn't have in 68 or 69, and that's all the electronic media, all the echo chambers, the internet, the web. We didn't have anything like Fox News in 1968. So we didn't have that kind of, in some ways, as I look at the media now, it almost suggests a little bit reminds me a little bit of what I think was what characterized the media in this country in the 18th and 19th century, is that there was a party press. And of course it was print press, not electronic, but that most papers were, in fact, loyal voices or echo chambers for the people that they supported or the parties that sponsored them or whatever. So we have a little bit like that. Fox seems to be a little bit like that, and maybe even some on the left are like that. I don't know. But we certainly didn't have in 68 this echo chamber of partisanship that we have now in the media.
Yeah. So it is interesting that when a surprise happens, when a shock happens, then you begin to look at what weren't we paying attention to? Who weren't we paying attention to? Who were we sort of just letting go? And they went. I want to move up a little further. In your writing, and in 2010, you published a book, Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America. And I'm just going to quote that one again briefly from the first chapter, and people will see again, that was 2010, 8 years ago. From the start, we fought about the same questions. Who belongs here? What does the economy need? What indeed is an American, or who is fit to be one? And then you quote the founding fathers. In 1751, Benjamin Franklin warned that Pennsylvania was becoming, quote, a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to Germanize us instead of our Anglifying them, and will never adopt our language or customs any more than they can acquire our complexion. Later, Jefferson worried about immigrants from foreign monarchies who will, quote, infuse into American legislation their spirit, warp and bias its direction, and render it a heterogeneous, incoherent, distracted mass. So those are the founding fathers. Sound familiar? What was the message of your book in 2010?
Well, I think the message was that, as we've always said, this is a country of immigrants, but we're also, for somewhat the same reason, a country that has had episodes of anti-immigration sentiment, and obviously the whole tradition of immigration that we celebrate obviously raises questions. And that was true from the beginning. If we're a perfect country, then who is it that's fit to be, to fit into our perfection? Or who is it that will enhance our perfection and not detract from it? And that is to some extent a legitimate question. You can't have totally open borders because for lots of reasons, though there are probably people who think we could. So we have to have some kind of standards or some kind of criteria about who can immigrate to this country and who can become a citizen. For a long time, we had something that was a provision that said that we don't want anybody who will become a public charge. We don't want people to come here and immediately have to be supported through welfare and health programs or whatever, simply for self-protection. So always had to be some kind of criteria. And, of course, at times, because of nativism and racism, we've elevated those criteria beyond all bounds. And so we're always arguing about between who should be able to come and who should not be able to come. We're now in one of those eras with Trump where the racist and the nativist element has become a very major factor in at least in the president's program. And we've had those episodes before. We had it in the 19th century with the know-nothingism. We had it in a major way beginning early in the 20th century, and then with the very tight immigration the so-called National Origins Quota Acts in the 1920s that sharply reduced immigration, as you know, until the end of the early years of the 20th century, we had pretty much open borders and open doors with some restrictions, Asians, restrictions on people from certain areas of the world, but to a large extent, we had pretty much open borders until the 1920s, and then we pretty much slammed the door from the late 1920s through the administration of Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. So we had about a 40-year period in which immigration as a percentage of our population was lower than it had ever been in our history.
And then
of course, the story I was trying to tell in that book.
Right. And since the, I think one of the things I got from it was sort of just to lend a historical perspective, just to lend that this has been a constant tension and a tension seized by opportunists at various times, as it was in 2016, when people are nervous, when people are afraid, and so on.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Oh, one question I want to ask about that. It is very clear, and it's part of the story of California, which we're going to get into, that immigration now supplies an awful lot of entrepreneurial energy. And if one thinks about it, it sort of makes sense. In other words, these are people that were willing to leave the past, leave their country, leave their families, leave their villages, leave their traditions to come here, that those would be the kind of people that stick their neck out in an entrepreneurial way as well.
That's correct.
Has that always been, it strikes me, but I'm asking you, having researched it more than I did, has that always been a facet of immigration?
Oh yes. I think the whole immigration process has always been, to some extent, self-selective. If you were, you had to be, in one way or another, strong-willed to come. Strong-willed in terms of all the things you just mentioned: change of culture, change of language, leaving family, leaving homes, leaving familiar places, all the rest of it. And the will, to some extent, was always for freedom, and to some extent was for opportunity, for a place to better yourself. And that's always been certainly a strain. And I think that's always been a kind of self-selective element in our history.
But I mean, was it true in the past that patents and new businesses and those sorts of things were also the products of immigration, as they so clearly are now?
Oh yeah, I think that's true. And some of the great entrepreneurs, Andrew Carnegie was an immigrant.
Marconi with the radio.
Marconi, I mean, all kinds of people that were
Tesla, yeah.
And so they were, you know, and at that time, most of them were immigrants from Europe.
Yeah.
And now, of course, here in California, I mean, Silicon Valley would not be what it is without immigrants from Asia.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Peter Schrag, author and longtime columnist and editor of the Sacramento Bee. And we're going to turn now to his latest book, California Fights Back, The Golden State in the Age of Trump. How central, Peter, is California to the way you see things, to your perspective, your worldview when you look out at the world?
Well, I mean, California has always been a major cultural force in this country. So much of what the country has become began here. This is as Joan Didion said, this is where we run out of continent.
Yep.
This is where things had better work here. and of course, we've had this great influence in culture and music with Hollywood, with the technology, with all sorts of things, not just in America, but overseas. And so I think California has always been its relationship to America has always been, in some ways, what America's relationship has been to the rest of the world. It was the biggest, it was whatever. Sometimes not for the best. I mean, there were certainly things that, there were awful things that happened in California, as we know, through our history. Chinese exclusion, the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II, which was a national policy but cheered by Californians. So we've had a lot of those kinds of things. We had a whole lot of racist stuff in our history.
Mm-hmm.
We murdered Indians by the thousands in the 19th century. So all of that is also part of the dark side of our history. But for the most part, we've been a kind of bright, shining symbol for much of the country, much of the world.
Okay, and in some sense, it's funny what we said about immigrants and, you know, the will and the inventiveness sort of that it takes to leave your country. California, in a way, has been that to the country because you end up moving here, and this is, you know, it's like folks who immigrated to the U.S., I think, some of that same personality type. So how and why did you come to write this new a book, California Fights Back, The Golden State in the Age of Trump? And let me add to that, the book runs only a little over 100 pages, and the publisher, Heyday Books, calls it a broadside. So what brought about this book, and why this book, and why this sort of punchy, short, let's get it out there?
You know, at my age, and when I'm in my 80s.
All right.
I think you get into a stage, call it the what the hell stage. You know, and this is my what the hell book. I mean, I've watched California as you said since the early 70s. I went to work for the Bee in 1978. I went through most of those traumatic years with Prop 13 and Prop 187, all the rest of it. So what happened? And then, of course, once Trump was elected, or even before Trump was elected, California was having done this flip from 1994, was going out of its way to be, and had always been very committed to environmental protection, environmental issues, because we had terrible experiences with the bad smog in L.A., 40, 50 years ago, with the oil spills and the pollution of the beaches off Santa Barbara. So we've had a lot of bad experiences with environmental disasters. So we've had a long past, and of course we have this wonderful environment. We've got, you know, I mean, there's no other place, maybe no other place on Earth that has this great combination of mountains and beaches and great forests, and, you know, and I mean, the environment is wonderful. And so we've had a lot to protect just in our own self-interest. But we did, as I said, even before, but certainly since the election of Trump, we've had a lot to protect in terms of our own institutions, our own laws, our own society, and a lot of what Trump and the Republicans, I should say in general, have basically stood for is very much antithetical to everything that California has become in the last 25 years.
Right.
On immigration, on marijuana, on the legalization of pot, on a whole range of things that are basically sometimes intentionally, but certainly at least coincidentally, anti-California.
Right, right. Your book seems to tell the similar story to the one I quoted in my intro about the same impulses in California. We saw them as we see now nationally: nativism with Prop 187, harsh justice system with three strikes, and so on. But it seems here they were at their worst 23 years ago. Is it your sense that California just went through this cycle sooner than the rest of the country, or than the center of the country and the South?
I think so, and there have been times when I've even thought when this was certainly true in the early years of the George W. Bush era, beginning in 2000, and people, a lot of people were saying California's out of it. The country is one place. California's this outlier, the left out, what some people call the left out coast, and the country was committed, for example, to the Iraq War. California was, for the most part, was not, partly because we were on the West Coast, but partly because we were probably always tending to be more blue than the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But my sense then was, and I think that's been borne out, is that California was not, in fact, the outlier, that California was ahead of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the country then turned against the Iraq War. The country, we've become an influence on the rest of the country. And I think, as we had been in the past, so I think that I was very, very pessimistic about California after Prop 13, and that book that you, Paradise Lost,
mm-hmm.
was a reflection of my pessimism. I used to have kind of discussions or arguments with Kevin Starr, the great California
yep.
historian,
yep.
a great, wonderful, brilliant guy, who at last passed away a few years ago, and he was always much more. He was by his nature, an ebullient California booster,
yeah.
Son of San Francisco. And I always thought he was too optimistic. He thought I was too pessimistic. But now, I as I said, my feeling about the state has changed. We're always going to be. We're always a volatile place. We're always going a little bit up and down, depending on the economy, depending on what's going on. And we certainly still have streaks of racism in the state. There's some very unreconstructed right-wing pockets, particularly in the Central Valley and Southern California. But by and large, I think we're in a very different place now from what we were and for what Trump wants to go. And, of course, California has acted on that.
Yeah,
we've been very active.
I want to get into that in more detail. But what you're saying is that it is your sense that we went through the cycle sooner, that we are somehow the vanguard, the harbinger. And one thing I was thinking as you were speaking during that even, that when the subprime crisis, when the tech boom and bust happened in the early 90s, that was California-centric. When the subprime crisis happened and took us down, a hell of a lot of it was in California.
Yes.
So it's like we don't always lead in the right direction, but we do. We are very much, it seems, the advance party for where we go. Before we talk some more about the fight, I do, because you're knowledgeable about it, want to talk about some of the challenges we still face. Right? What do you think are our biggest current challenges? And I know that one of them that you've written about and talked about is our fiscal mess.
Our fiscal mess?
Yeah, in other words,
yes.
that we still are, no matter how well we do, we're always saddled with Prop 13.
We're still saddled with Prop 13, though there's a growing movement in Sacramento to try to modify at least the commercial property tax system so that commercial property would be taxed at somewhere close to its real value, rather than this cockamamie system we have now. We continue to protect residential property, a taxation on residential property, but would essentially allow the appraisals on commercial property to follow the real value and not some past system that basically allows people to hold property taxes way down, way below what they should be paying, to be economically efficient, and not just because of fairness,
right,
but because of efficiency.
Yeah. Now let me just mention to people who might be outside California and not know exactly what Prop 13 is, passed in 1978, and what it does is it sort of artificially holds down property taxes. As your real estate value goes up, your property taxes do not match that. And let me, two things I learned from looking at some of your writing was that in 1978, homeowners paid 55% of property taxes, and today they pay 72%. That the commercial side of this, when Prop 13 was passed, it applied equally to commercial and to residential, that the commercial side have taken advantage of it in a way that homeowners probably do not realize. The other thing you point out is that majority ownership of corporations, that is to say, who owns the corporation, if it's owned by shares and so on, that it probably turns around every 3 years or so. So in fact, that owner that's keeping the same tax rate as a residential owner is no longer that same owner, but yet commercial forces have kept legislators and the government from dealing with this by lumping them both together. So you think there's a chance that we might move in this direction and change it so that it splits the two?
There's been a lot of people working on it for some years, and in fact for many, many years. And so there's talk now about going back to the ballot. I'm not sure it would occur this year, but it may well occur in 2020, to essentially revise the system of the assessment system on commercial property. So it would track more closely with current value rather than with the value of that of what it was
when the property
was last transferred, which might have been 20 or 30 years ago.
Right. And one thing that we know is that whenever that comes up, whether it comes up in Sacramento or it comes up in a proposition, you can bet the money against it will be huge.
Oh, of course, absolutely. The corporate money will be enormous, and but you know, things like that, it may be possible to beat that. I don't know, and I'm not sure I'm going to be around to see it, but it will happen at some point. But the state has other ongoing fiscal problems. It still has a huge overhang of unfunded pension liabilities for retirees. I'm talking now public employees, teachers, and all the rest, cops, whatever. That is going to be a problem in the future, and is already beginning to eat away at current expenses because the chunk of the pension chunk keeps becoming a larger share of public expenses. So there's that. As I say, there's a residual always. The fear of some kind of backlash. California and Jerry Brown, our governor, has again warned just the other day about being prepared for a coming downturn in our economy, which could happen any day. And California's public funding is very volatile because so much of it is dependent on high incomes, and when things go bust, when the market goes into the tank, our state revenues go down very fast. So that's a threat.
Danger. And just so people understand, that also has to do with Prop 13. Is that in most states, property taxes cover a lot of local government, including your schools and your protective services. In California, because there's this lock on property taxes, we have to raise that money through income taxes and sales taxes and then send it from Sacramento to the local jurisdictions, which makes us much more vulnerable. If a bust happens, it'll affect real estate, but not as much as it will affect income in the stock market.
That's correct. There's one other element that we haven't talked about, which is important, and that is that our terrible housing shortage.
Yep.
And particularly housing for middle and low income people, which is dreadful, and which is causing all kinds of problems. And I know you've got it down in L.A. and we've got all the homeless encampments here under the freeway overpasses and whatever, which is awful in all kinds of ways, and that also to some extent. It's really the result of two things, or three, I should say. One is obviously our prosperity, which has driven up home prices all over the place.
Right.
The second is, again, oddly enough, is the environmental, our complicated environmental regulations and laws, which have made it possible for a lot of NIMBYism to kind of thrive because we've got this whole overlay of regulations.
Right, so if a neighborhood doesn't want affordable housing near it or in it, they can fight it on environmental grounds.
Ways to stop it or slow it down, restrict it, whatever, so there's that. And then again, there's Prop 13, which has basically discouraged the use of the best use of land. And so a lot of land that should be developed, an infill that should be developed, is held off the market because you don't suffer any penalty when its value goes up, but your taxes don't go up.
Got it. Right. Okay, let's shift to California's fighting back. You point out that the California really stands as the alternative model to Washington, which now is attempting to sort of replicate Kansas, if you will. Which anybody who's been following Kansas knows what I mean by that. But you say that California's resistance encompasses two different strands, that they're fighting for two different things at the same time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the one is to protect what we've just talked about is the progressivism of the state and its progressive policy, and so we're protecting that. We're also a model for the country, but much of the resistance has come from the attempt to protect our environmental laws, our environmental regulations, the immigrants in this, not to allow our own law enforcement resources to be used to enforce and crack down on deport people who've lived among us for maybe decades. So we've done all the sanctuary bills, local sanctuary laws, which has, of course, driven Trump and Jeff Sessions crazy. And we've done this across the board. And then we, as I said, our Attorney General, Javier Becerra, has been very active in filing suits on a whole range of things, particularly on environmentally related things. We're going to resist offshore drilling, of course, auto emission standards, which are higher here than almost anywhere, but which have become a model for a number of other states. And again, we've held firm on that. So there's been a whole series of things that have resisted the attempt by the federal government, by the Trump administration, and of course a lot of things they can do that we can't stop. We can't force Scott Pruitt, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, from not enforcing environmental laws. We can't stop Trump from saber rattling with North Korea. There's a whole series of things that we can't do, but the things that we can do, pretty much we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. And talk to us a little bit more about Becerra, Xavier Becerra. Xavier Becerra was a congressman, and he was, at least within the Democratic Party, had been there, I think, 23 years. So he was in leadership positions on committees within the minority and so on. And when Jerry Brown, when Kamala Harris ran successfully for the Senate, thus giving up her Attorney General role, it was kind of a key move for Jerry Brown to pick that next Attorney General. Becerra was a very specific and intentional move, don't you think?
I believe so. I think so. I mean, both Becerra, for a time when he was in Congress, chaired the Latino Caucus. He's been very much a committed, and he himself grew up in an immigrant family in Sacramento, working class family. Managed to get to Stanford and Stanford Law School, which is itself, a great American story, not unique by any means, but again, a great American story, and has been a very committed advocate for the rights of immigrants. And of course, now immigrants means, certainly in California, means Latinos, primarily, but also Asians and some others. But that reflects also, again, the state's sensibility and its changed sensibility from 1994 about the immigrants among us. And as immigrants are now, or Latinos, or white, let's start do it backwards, Anglo-whites are now just another minority in California.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, Latinos will be an absolute majority. And that's, of course, been reflected in our politics. And all of that, it seems to me, Becerra is symbolic of, in a way. And Jerry Brown, it's interesting. Jerry Brown, as far as I know, has never attacked Trump personally, has never said Trump is a liar, he's a cheat, he's a fraud, he's a racist, whatever. But in everything he's done, it's been pointed at the Trump administration. And I shouldn't say everything, but many things that he's done. And certainly the appointment of Becerra, I think, was indicative of that intention. I mean, he could have picked any number of people.
Right. And he picked someone who he felt was both a champion and a capable champion of the fight.
Absolutely. And as I say, and Becerra has been very active. I don't know how many suits he's either threatened or has actually filed.
I think it's over 20 at this point.
It could be. And there's only one other, as far as I know, there's only one other attorney general who's been as active or nearly as active, and that's in New York,
Schneiderman. Yeah,
who's been terrific on this.
Yeah, one of the things, let me just point out for listeners who don't know this about Schneiderman's work in New York, is that he has been tying the Russian investigation and things like that to state laws, because he knows that that Trump can pardon everyone if the only cases are federal. But if you make cases, state cases in New York, that they're money laundering or things on Wall Street, he has no right to pardon those. A powerful strategy by Schneiderman. So we've got Becerra. We've got the legislature. They urge federal prosecutors to file the toughest. Sessions wants to ramp up punishments and so on and take the justice reform backwards. The state legislature has passed a bill repealing sentence enhancements for prior drug convictions and so on. Talk just a little bit about the 7 Republican California seats in Congress are targeted by the Democrats. What are the prospects for turning those, and how big a deal will that make in terms of 2018 turning the entire Congress?
Well, as you know, 2 have already quit, or have said they're quitting. 2 of the ISA and Royce,
yeah,
and there are a couple of others that may be who knows. That doesn't mean that they will then be replaced by Democrats.
Right,
they could be replaced by other Republicans, and could be. But there's certainly a chance. And again, it depends. I think there's several things that are in play here. I think the most obvious is DACA, the Dreamers. If Congress passes something that will allow the Dreamers to stay, then that wouldn't apply. But if in fact, as is looking like, the Congress will fail to basically allow the Dreamers to stay or pass legislation to allow the Dreamers to stay, then those 7. Particularly those that are in districts that are heavily Latino, they will be in more trouble. Then, of course, there's the question of to what extent will the tax law, the new tax law, bite people before the election. And it's not clear that it will, because
the way it was written
in such a way so that the real bite won't happen for several years down the road for most people. In the meantime, the rich will get richer. And then there's one other factor I'm forgetting, and I'll think of it in a minute.
Okay. By the way, the 7, when I mentioned 7 seats, it doesn't mean there are only 7 seats held by Republicans in California. I'm not sure what that number is.
There are 14.
But they picked these 7 seats because these are 7 where Hillary either did very well against Trump, even though they had a Republican congressman, or Hillary beat Trump, even though they had
a Republican congressman.
That's so these are considered vulnerable folks.
That's correct. And these are districts that are changing, where the electorate is becoming increasingly Latino, not a majority, but a significant percentage. So, and that, of course, again, would be affected by the DACA decision. Or by the lack of a decision on DACA.
If you want to kind of sum up the message of this book or the message that you want people to get, what is it?
Well, I think the message is that California was where Trump wants the country to be, and California has come a long way since then. And so California the history of the last 25 years in California, I think, is a good model for many other parts of the country.
So, again, the book is California Fights Back, The Golden State in the Age of Trump. It's 110 pages. It's both a broadside you can pick up in print, but it's also an e-book. Thank you, Peter Schrag, for all the work you've done in California over all these years and for the work you're doing now. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, Terrence McCauley.
Okay. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 6-7 articles of relevance, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site. You can listen anytime, anywhere. They include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, on and on. Thanks to G, my engineer, Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.